Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I run SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have TalkCast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, at least around there. And if you want to call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talks website at www.talkshoe.com and search for call ID 17702. Or if you want to join us on Twitch, just go to twitch.tv/SFU on call. I will start up that stream around 9:30, 9:35. Just be patient. It will be started. And I'll keep an eye on the chat room. So if you want to chat there, I'd be happy to respond to any questions or comments that you have within reason, of course. And of course, you need to contact me for any reason. My email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, my account there is sfuoncall. And of course, my personal account, which is Paul Franz, PAULFRNZ, which you want to do, you can follow me there. I talk about technology and being Catholic. So those are two things that if you don't want to follow me, that might be a reason. If you want to just about the podcast, what's going on there, just follow the podcast feed and you'll get to find out what the current topic is for this evening. And the quick news from A to B this week. I'm Steve Cole, of course, is still working on those FedCom play by email cards for the library. Also, we have people working on the Andromeda X ships, you know, on Shapeways is going to be beautiful. They look like the ones, if you ever looked at the module C3A cover, it's just like that ship that's right there on the cover. Moving on, went forward to the SFB Online tournament, the Sapphire Star Tournament 4, round 2 is complete. Round 3, the first of the semifinal round games, have been completed with Mad Jack beating Rom Wee. And Peter Bakia is going to have to face Ben, I forget his last name. Gorn versus Klingon, which he'll have to fight again, because that's exactly what Peter played in the first round. He defeated him, and I feel pretty confident that Peter probably will beat him too. And that would make the final a great black shark with two drone racks versus the Gorn, which would make thing a very, very good game, I think. I think that'd be excellent. I can't wait for that to occur, and I'm hoping to watch the whole thing. Moving on to the library report for this week. Completing conversion is still only 2,522. Yet to be converted, being 799. Leaving a percent complete is 75.94%. And with that, that is the news for this week. It is me, the one and the only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight, we've got me, we got Gary, we got Dave. Barry's not here. Which throws the current topic out the window. So, we were going to discuss the Sigvarians, and that kind of went out the window with Barry not being here, because usually we discuss it with him, and he understands the Omega systems quite well. And of course, then his opinion on, because currently we do have a Sigvarian tournament cruiser, but you know, say the very least, it's not exactly great. No, I don't. We've never discussed the X rules for the Andrews from Module C3A, which actually it's been a long time since I've actually looked at Module C3A. The one big thing I remember seeing from Module C3A. I'm sorry, I'm replying to Gary, who's in the chat room. So if you want to talk to you, you know, the chat room's available. I'm currently streaming on Twitch. I'm having an issue with Twitch that I can't watch the chat room on Twitch while I'm actually doing my podcast here. So I'm gonna fix that. I'll be fixing that very soon. I might just grab a laptop because it seems like it doesn't like it when I'm, or maybe I have to log out of my account, log into a different account. That might do it. That probably will do it. Okay. Yeah, I'll try something. But anyway, so I can monitor the chat room on Twitch, and I apologize if anyone's on there tonight that I'm unable to see you, see any chats. But if still, you can listen to me and watch my wonderful voice and wonderful face. And of course, as I also screencast the entire thing so that you get an idea of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about it. One thing Gary was pointing out is that starting right before the show, which before the show started, that is this. For those on the podcast, you don't see it because you're just listening. But basically, it's about the Dromedant X ships that were shown in the Dromedant Threat File Module C3A, which is, I think, really cool. The biggest thing that I'm sure everyone who's ever read that module, ever bought it and read through it, is the dissection beam, which is quite cool. I love the dissection beam, where it slices and dices a ship. You know, it kind of reminds you of the beam from the Borg from Star Trek, The Next Generation. The whole idea of kind of slicing and dicing a ship, which is, to say the very least, I forget how the damage works on that, on the dissection beam. But these are, for those who are viewing it, we have some quick models. It's 2D models. At this point, top-down view of the X ships, Andromeda X ships, which actually when these come out, I'm gonna get at least one of each, if not more, because these look really cool Andromedan ships. I love what happened with the Adam Turner. This is what he created. Because if you've ever looked at the Andromedan threat file cover, the cover for that, for module C3A, this is what you'll see. You'll see, I think it's like an intruder. Really, I don't think we can tell whether it's an intruder, a conquistador, or a python. My guess is it's an ex-intruder. And it has, this really advanced style to it versus these, which look kind of really... the older ones are kind of clunky, kind of simple, but this has a kind of, sorry, I got a cat who loves attention. Here, Granny, say hello. Hello. Goodbye. So, okay, Gary just pointed out, that one, yes, I was correct, that it was an Intruder X shown on the cover, and there are rules for the X version of the dissection beam, but no SSD yet to use it. As I said earlier, I don't remember the rules for the dissection beam, but that was one of those prominent systems that was in the threat file. I know there's all kinds, the whole idea of the threat file, for those of you who have never bought it or even looked at it, the whole idea of it was that when the Andromedans attacked, nobody knew what they were. They never, all of these intelligence agencies, the GIA is the one that everyone knows, that's the Federation one. I know there's other ones. Somebody tells me, Gary will tell me some of the names of those. But the intelligence agencies had these ideas about the Andromeda's capabilities of what they can and cannot do, because they didn't know what they could do. So they had to come up with a threat file, and you know, which was what could they possibly do. And there was all these really neat ideas. I still remember when Steve Cole first presented it. Meaning, you know, he said, this is what we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing a threat file. And the whole idea is all these crazy ideas that the Andromedans could have done. Because I know my craziest idea was actually the having it so that the Andromedans actually captured shuttles and then were able to also capture, you know, drones from other ships, you know, because they didn't destroy all the ships. In some cases, they actually were able to salvage things from the ships and maybe even take those. I was thinking about taking the shuttles and the drones and basically have a scatter pack that the Andromedans could then they pop it into space, you know, they transport it into space because they have their transporters, they can transport their satellite ships. Why can't they transport a shuttle which they own and deploy it that way, you know? Or possibly even, you know, more of a captor mine kind of thing where they were able to capture the drones and they attach them to these mines with some control. So they figured out a control system for it, and then they used it that way. Now, obviously, from the looks of the history of the Andromedans, the Andromedans didn't really loop the loop back when it comes to facing the enemies and looping back to produce a ship that can then be modified to that threat. That loop back was too long, way too long, because of what it looks like is that they had a prepared number of ships that they were sending to the galaxy, and they figured, okay, we can take them. But the problem was that the Galactics, what they did was that they had that loop back where they figured out what they needed against the Andromedans to defeat them. And then they produced those kind of ships. You know, they had the X ships that were faster, and yeah, they were producing the X ships, not as a completely as a deterrent to the Andromedans but that's more of, because of, basically, they lived in an age of war. And in that age of war, you needed to have faster, stronger, more, you know, better equipped ships to defeat your enemy. And that's why the X-ships were produced. And then they found out, you know, that they figured out that the Andromedans had these RTNs, you know, this network of bases which they could easily and very quickly jump from one base to another in a very short period of time. And so the Andromedans didn't have that many ships. It's just that the ships could go far distances very fast, faster than the galactic ships could go. And of course, things being as they were, because it was a state of war, certain pieces of information were probably not shared between different empires. For example, you know, if they had, I'm assuming that the Andromedans had certain designations on their ships, maybe, I don't know, because obviously, in my mind, if you're going to have that kind of network to make yourself look like you have more ships than you do, But I'm not sure they were even trying to do that, because obviously that's one thing that you might want to do as a person that's coming in to invade, is that you want to hide the true number of your ships that you have, so that your enemy never knows how many ships that you truly have. And to do that, I would think that, okay, you don't actually have designations on the ships themselves. So there's no way to know, okay, that this ship was exactly the same ship that we saw earlier, you know, because there's no designation on the ship itself. You know, and you could have designations more of through transponders, which only you know the keys to, you know, have it so that it was encrypted. And so the communications for the transponders, it's, you know, check to make sure, okay, it's definitely a friendly ship, and then send the code which says, okay, this is my designation. So that, you know, they can track their ships, but externally there was no way to know that it was the same ship. In which case, you know, it would make it even more difficult for the any place you're invading and jump and using the network to travel quickly between points to identify, oh, that's the same ship. The only way is say, okay, well, wait a minute. On this battle, there was this kind of damage, and then the same kind of ship shows up with, you know, same kind of battle damage, that, and they could use that as markers, which obviously, you know, as, you know, attacker, you'd want to conceal that as much as possible, but you can't. There's only so much of that you actually can do. So, but, you know, the threat file, do I have it? Oh, sorry. Not. There. This is for those on the watching the video, this is what the threat file looked like, which is, in my mind, a quite cool looking ship. Improved satellite ships, plasma pods, suicide slits. Okay, let me look at this for a moment. Page 8. Suicide sleds. Okay, suicide freighters have been in use in the Alpha Octon since Y-150. As an Andromedan threat grew, the intelligence agency of the various Star Empires began considering the possibility that such freighters might be used by them. Cargo sleds seemed like they might easily be adapted for the mission, particularly if they could be delivered to the targets by the motherships. So basically the whole idea of suicide freighters, but as cargo sleds, which of course improves pseudo. So they could simulate the Cobra, but virtually every empire assumed that the Andromedans could program pseudo satellite ships to simulate any kind of satellite, and other issues would be made. Historically, Andromedans never made any of these improvements. In this case, faster speed ships, you know, max YA3, you know, pseudo satellite ships can accelerate up to a maximum of 20, and in Y185 up to speed of 30. And then this one lines what I was thinking of, which is borrowing the tech from other races. Sorry, empire. Sorry, Gene. This case, the various empires' constant concern of the dramas might adapt the weapons they were encountering in the Milky Way for their own use. Historically, this never occurred, though simulators were rife with such designs. These are the most forward version of the TR beams to photons, disruptors, and we did not wish to clutter the plug with obvious SSDs. One of the most intriguing developments, which unfortunately the Andromedans never developed, was plasma module. This was, in essence, a battle pod that could be carried by any mothership, Devastator, Dominator, Intruder, Conqueror, or Conquistador, and soon was allowed to launch plasma torpedoes by transporter. The plasma torpedoes created plasma were identical to those used by plasma empires. The only difference is the method of launch, which imposed limits on the minimum range. Perennities of plasma bolts, obviously, or carronade, forced the plasma torpedoes to rely entirely on their own guidance. Unless otherwise stated by these rules, all the rules pertaining to plasma torpedoes are, you know, are used. That, I agree, that would be quite interesting. Oh, there's a neat one. Change the displacement device feedback element. Andromeda operators were observed for an extended period, and it was noted they were never more than two of the cruiser, later Dreadnought, besides motherships. While the motherships operated varied groups of satellite ships, resulting in forces of as small as a single Conquistador and one satellite ship, as large as two Dominators and 16 Viper satellite ships. Woo! That's a lot of ships. There's no discernible reason there would not be more displacement device equipped ships. It was not until Operation Unity during Andromeda attempt to pull back from a battle after a base had been destroyed that displacement device effect phenomenon was encountered. Prior to that point, Andromeda forces and slimmers could be configured to use any known satellite ships, resulting in a larger use of displacement device that would than ever encountered in actual operations. This rule removes the restrictions from G18.8, and there is no displacement device feedback, and any unit may use its displacement device to maximum effect. Yikes. Which, to me, would be quite interesting. Because then, what is it? Darn it. There was a... No, it's the Python. I'm being dumb. I'm being an idiot. I'm sorry. Because I originally was thinking about what was the Python class ship that has a displacement device? The Python. Oh, shocker. I feel a little dumb at the moment. That would make things interesting because in theory, a Python can be a satellite ship. Because it's the same size as the Mamba. The only difference is that the Python has a displacement device. So, in theory, you could have, like a Dominator transport out a multiple Pythons and then have them, instead of being stuck at speed 10, then could still be stuck at speed 10, but then could use their displacement devices after the fire control becomes active, and then you have a whole squadron of Python ships, which could go basically a much further distance because of self-displacement is up to 12 hexes. So that you can, in theory, have a group attack using Pythons to be, you could start out, you could jump in from what was maybe around range 15, then you could jump into range 3 really quick. And Lord have mercy on any ISC ship that occurs to because of the any PPDs done. Of course, then we still have the plasma to deal with, but, those are the breaks. That's one thing I must admit that The Andromedas definitely were designed to be played in fleets. But to any person who's actually played an Andromeda in a fleet battle, you know, that the whole thing with, you know, the Andromeda and having all that speed and just can run around the map with no issue whatsoever. Motherships can't do that. I remember the first time I ever played a Dominator with like a full complement of satellite ships. The Dominator has quite a bit of power and has quite a bit of battery. It's okay. The problem is that you might be able to move a maximum of like speed 15 in that Dominator because of if you want to be able to transport out those satellite ships, each one of those satellite ships takes an awful lot of energy. And if you want to transport them back in, then you have to pay for it twice. So you can't go that fast. Hey, Gary. Gary? Oh. Gary, I can't hear you. You're not muted.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, there we go. So, I was off the call for a bit, but did you talk too much about C3A, or do you have the file open or anything? Or?
Yeah, I got the file open up. I actually talked about some different things, including I discussed what happens when you remove the restriction on the displacement devices and, you know, the displacement device feedback phenomenon and saying, okay, there is no phenomenon. Because that's one of the options in C3A.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering if, since we're with the whole Shapeways thing going on, I think I was wondering if it might be an option to have a look at the Intruder X SSD or even just talk about the adjustments to the systems and stuff.
Sure. Let me. Okay, there it is. Wasn't sure if the file I had had separate one for SSDs or not, and it does not. Okay, so Andromeda and Heavy Mamba. Wow. Conquer new fighter.
Look at this. What the heck? It's on page 89 or page 90 of the PDF.
Page 90 of the PDF. 95. Anaconda. Oh, that's a neat one. There's Python. There's the Conquistador. There it is. Okay. And let me do this. Let me rotate it. Do that. Rotate left and rotate left. There it is. Were the batteries any better in the X-ships for the Andromedans?
They are. I'm just going to go back up because there's a separate page which has the various X-rules on it, which is, I guess when it's all just one file, that's kind of awkward. But let me see now. Okay, so first of all, power absorbers, they can absorb 9 points of power when at standard levels and 15 points at reinforced levels.
Right. Wow.
So I'm guessing if there was ever any Federation Commander rules, that it would be set to 15 by default. And then, you know, well, in theory, because, I mean, we'd have to wait and see.
Right.
Battery.
Well, I would think it was just 15 by default in FedCom because there is no idea of standard mode in FedCom.
Yeah, Andromeda X batteries hold 6 points of power.
Okay, where's the X rules? What page? On the PDF?
They start on page 49, which is page 50 of the PDF.
Okay, page 50 of the PDF. Okay. I'll get there because I put a bookmark for the 50, improved technology. Okay. Okay, actually, okay, it's 49. And the PDF. Power absorbers, yep. Disruptor leaks is total damage from disruptor equal to 3 points per panel box. Yay.
Yeah, the degradation has been reduced down to 10% as well.
25% of the power can be transferred to batteries instead of 10. Okay. It can dissipate 2 points of energy from the panels. If I recall correctly, darn, I have to see if I have a, maybe I have to get a old copy of the rules. Because I almost think that originally, back in the day, before they got added degradation so far in the Captain's Edition, the amount of power that could be absorbed into the batteries, I thought it was 25% back then. And then they changed it to 10. Andromeda's first generation X-ships can... Okay, so make sure I'm still here. Okay. Wow, you actually can hold heavy TR beams. And light, you can hold them. Wow. Fast loading, fast first generation display from device. Ooh. Range on allocating of total amount of power required for a single turn. During a single turn, so it's 4 points. Wow.
What's interesting is that, from what I can tell, there's no range limit for the fast loaded TR beams either, because for some empires, when they fast load one of their weapons, they're limited to range 15.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it'd be still, even, okay, power absorbers, anything with, there's a dissection beam, plasma pods, which I thought were quite an interesting technology. What the heck's this? Power absorbers of energy.
Which one?
I'm just, okay. See, I heard, see, this says seeking energy modules, like, which actually, I have not actually read that section of, you know, GC 8.0. I assume that, what is that more of a leech or something? I don't know.
Because I usually skip over the purely simulator ones. I mean, simulator chips. I mean is that weapons like the dissection beam, they're quote unquote real because they existed in the alternate timeline. But and it's not entirely impossible that the Andromedans might have X ships back in their home galaxy. But usually, like if there was an X ship to appear at some point future later in the timeline, it would make more sense. I mean, because the thing about C3A is that it gives you the option of throwing in all these extra simulator things if you want, but if you want to pair it back, you can do that as well. So I'm trying to actually plasma pods. No.
Yeah. Actually, it makes me think about after the desecrator base was destroyed in the LMC, and after, I remember reading that after that, the Andromedans basically just became a nuisance. You know, they attack here and there, and they just were kind of brushed off, and they became a nuisance instead of attacking force. Which makes me wonder, why were they attacking at all? I would think in that case, basically survival. I would think at that point.
Well, there's a thread on the BBS. It's purely speculative at this point, but I was actually wondering in it, because if you look over in Japan right now, they're currently in the process of developing a new maglev-based Shinkansen line, the Chuo Shinkansen.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually it's going to run. There was supposed to be a sample track that people could go on for the Tokyo Olympics, but that's not happening now. unless it happens in 2021. Yeah. But the plan, it was supposed to be that there'd be a portion of the line going from Tokyo to Nagoya. But the thing is that unlike previous Shinkansen, which could expand or retrofit the existing track lines, the new maglev one, it can't run on the old train, the old line. So they have to basically construct an entirely new network. And also, and most of it is actually going through tunnels because I guess the gradation is different and stuff like so. Right. You can't have it go too far up or too down or whatever. But the actual train itself, I think they said it's going to be something like 100 or 150 kilometers an hour faster than the current one or something.
Mm-hmm.
But so what I was thinking is that perhaps one way to explain why there was no sign of any X ships historically is because they're not here yet. So maybe what the Andromedans need to do is build a new advanced version of the trunk line explicitly for their X ships and run that to, you know, whichever galaxy they're going to, and then deploy their X ship that way. So
that's possible. Yeah. I was pointing out earlier, I think the whole issue with the Andromedans is that they didn't have a feedback loop where they could actually take their experiences from the forces that they're fighting against and improving their ships to account for those weapon systems, you know?
Well, that's why, because I think if you look in the Alpha Octant, the X ships, they can go faster and so forth, whatever, but it's the infrastructure. I mean, yes, the Alpha Empires have to build X bases, but the X ships can still run on the regular strategic movement network and so forth. So, I mean, it's better if you have the better base, but it's not like the rules in Federation of Empire that tell you how far apart a base has to be for you to be able to deploy X ships between them. It's based on the ship, not on the base. But I wouldn't be surprised if for the Andromedans, it's actually based on the base, not on the ship. So maybe I basically say that they simply can't run an X ship, X1 or X2, on the pre-existing network. So, but it is actually worth noting that
makes no sense. To be honest, I would think it would be more like in software. Or better yet, a television transmission where the whole idea is that you have backwards compatibility. Yes, you don't get some of the advanced features, but you can still go, in this case, you know, if it's not an upgraded base, it can go the slower speed, but can still go pretty fast. Versus, you know, if it was an X base, they could actually transport at even faster speeds that are allowed by the X ships. That would be my guess. And as I pointed out, I think the issue was loopback, that there was no feedback loop to modify the ships. And even if they have a feedback loop, that feedback loop is way too long, because, you know, It's like they have, because if you look at the history of the invasion when it comes to the forces that they were given, it's like that they said, okay, this is how much we need to defeat these guys, but that also assumes that they don't improve technologically speaking, that they just have the ships that they currently have, and so this is what we need. So we send the forces and we have this waves of buildup that we have, and then after we defeat them, we can ease back on that. But so yeah, in theory, what I can see happening is in a maybe X2 time frame that they could bring the Andromedans back, as you know, that they're not done with us yet. Kind of, you know, that, but with more advanced ships, you know, in this case, you know, the X ships from the Andromedans.
Well, the thing about to bear in mind is that whatever Operation Unity happened, they found that the second of the three desecrators was actually being used to build the Devastator battleship. And over in the Darwin's Dark Future timeline, they completed those ships and they were able to use them. and also deploy the dissection beam. So there seems to be some sort of logistical thing, because the question is, do they have battleships in the home galaxy, yes or no? And if the answer is yes, then why did they have to build them here? Like, why not just fly them in? What if there's some sort of bandwidth issue on the intergalactic trunk line where they can't basically, like maybe the Devastators are too big to be flown from one galaxy to another along it. So they have to build them on site. And it could have been that they thought the invasion was going well enough without them that the resources that they had were directed elsewhere. But it's only later on when they got to the point where they felt that these more powerful ships would be necessary, that's when they basically started cracking it open. So, because it seems that that second starbase was actually left kind of crippled. Like, it wasn't even repaired up until about Y-200. So for a long time, they didn't do anything with that base. One thing I was thinking of is that because there's been a lot of discussion about the Andromedans on the BBS lately. And one thing I was thinking of was the reason why potentially, we don't know for sure because they won't tell us. But they as in the Andromedans, not they as in ADB.
Right.
But one reason why the Andromedans picked the LMC in the first place was because it doesn't seem to have much of an energy barrier. So maybe there's something about the energy barrier that makes it impossible to build a starbase in the galaxy itself, or do more difficult. Or whatever it is.
But at the same time, logistically speaking, it makes perfect sense, because the LMC is relatively close to the Milky Way, and more importantly, there wasn't nearly as much of a resistance in the LMC, because they were able completely to take over the LMC. There were some native ships left behind. Four native forces that were battling with them every once in a while, but they're more nuisance than anything else at that point.
What I mean is that it'd be interesting if it turned out that Andromeda, the galaxy itself, because it's known that at least M81 has a barrier, but that it's weaker than the one that Milky Way has. So the Tholians, for example, learned the hard way that it's much more difficult to get through our barrier.
Right.
So maybe Andromeda has its own barrier. So it could be that one of the reasons why there is no direct evidence of the trunk line is because it never went directly to the M31 itself, that the Andromedans might have conquered their satellite galaxies and then used them to launch the trunk line to other, galaxy adjacent targets.
Right.
So I think that kind of thing might be interesting. But I don't know. I mean, I know that the big bad for X2 will be the Zorkalians, but so I don't know whether or not ADB would want to have the Andromedans in reserve. But I mean, on the other hand, as long as it's something different, because I guess that's what that'd be the handy thing about these Andromedan X ships, or possibly once X2 comes out for Alpha, whenever that is. One could then figure out, well, what would the Andromedan answer to that be? And, there's probably some way to keep them, as at least the potential of, something different, if that makes sense.
Right. Of course, here's the difficult part, the way I see it, for the Andromedans and the Milky Way overall, in that the biggest thing that the Andromedans had for them when they invaded the Milky Way, obviously first they took over the LMC, then they attacked the Milky Way. And that is the element of surprise. We didn't know how they operated. When it comes to the RTN network and how the ships worked and so forth. So they had kind of had the surprise in their the element of surprise for attacking. So, because it was obviously when you don't know what strength your enemy is, you hold back a little bit, because of you don't know what he can do, and you want to find out what he can do so you know what you can do against them, or whether it's better to leave the field of battle and so forth. So the question is, in my mind, is that when it comes to Andromeda's X ships or any other Andromedan ships in Starfleet universe, it is where? Would they attempt another invasion of the Milky Way, or would they attempt, or would the next invasion attempt be at some other galaxy like the old Tholian galaxy, M81? No.
Well, I suppose it's possible that they were already targeting other galaxies like Triangulum and stuff.
Right,
We don't know for sure about Triangulum because the Triangulum history only goes to a certain point, but it would seem reasonable. But I mean, yes, there is a point to be said that the people would know their trick in terms of the RTN. So
right.
Unless there's like maybe their satellite bases, the X-ship ones, maybe they have a longer range that they can be between bases, because like it hasn't been said for sure how far apart the current bases have to be.
Right.
But for argument's sake, say if you said they have to be four F&E apart. Yeah, that's right. Four. Like, say if it's, no, I'd just say like if it was four, maybe X bases could be a few more hexes or something. Right. Not too far, but right. Basically make it more that it's more of a challenge to find each one, so that they don't need as many to be placed for them to be able to strike. Now, I wouldn't necessarily give them any kind of cloak or stealth system or something, because I don't think that really suits them. Right. But I think one advantage that they could have is if the Zorkalians or someone else distracts the Empires too much, or if they start fighting each other again, that could basically be their in, where their enemies basically think, oh, we've already got it sorted, we'll take the foot off the gas. And then it basically, they don't have to take another 30 years to build up a RTN 2.0 right. or RTNX, whatever. They could maybe take 5 or 10.
Right.
And then suddenly more trouble is afoot, and it's harder to catch up with them.
Yeah.
And also, one thing that's interesting is that I guess it's been suggested that maybe X2 might not have the same size limitation that X1 has, because with X1, you can't build bigger than a heavy command cruiser in X-ship. Like, you can't do X-dreadnoughts or whatever,
right.
unless you're Jandarian rock ships or whatever. And so that logic was brought into C3A. So the Andromedan Intruder X is the biggest X-ship that they have. But in theory, if X2 for Alpha is allowed to build bigger ships than our X2, then maybe the Andromedans could too. So maybe it could be that, they don't just have a Devastator. They have an X2 Devastator, which is like, I don't know how many points that would be. But they're able to basically scale up to match their opponents. But it would tie back to the thing I was talking earlier about the maglevs and stuff, where maybe they need an entirely new intergalactic network to support them. So, or at least to get the most out of them.
Right. I think the big thing for a next generation Andromedan would be the basis, or would be the key to those, because that's what was the key to the first attack. And more to the point, it's not that they need cloaking device, because putting a base in the middle of nowhere is hard to freaking find. But what caused the downfall of the network was the trails. Now, obviously the Andromedans, they did their best to hide the trails by creating these false trails that went out in the middle of nowhere. But the idea of having no trail at all would be a better thing. Can that be done? Don't know. But Maybe you have.
Well, that's kind of what the stealth field does for the Zosmans, because it masks their warp flare. But I don't know if I want to have too much spillover between the two empires in that sense.
Oh, understood. But that would be the key for the Andromedans, is have some way of masking their trails, so that basically they could not be tracked. That is the key in my mind for a successful attack. Because even if you find one of their bases, you can't destroy the whole network. They could easily rebuild that node someplace else. You know, and maybe even, you know, if you have to, make two bases, you know, route it, make it a little bit longer, maybe route it around that point so that, you know, it makes it even harder to find. It might take a little bit longer to reroute it, but at the very least at that point, it would be harder to find. You know, it would definitely be harder to find. It might cost you more, but you'd be okay. You know, the whole idea, because that's what was the real issue that happened with the Andromedans, is that the RTN network was broken down, so that slowed down how fast the ships could move, you know, strategically. So in my mind, that is where they would need to be improved. Yes, they'd have to have improved ships because of obviously their opponent is improved. And I would think at the very least, the initial Andromedan attack would send back reports about those battles, you know, and so that the ships could be improved. At the very least, even if it wasn't for retaking or reattacking, you know, try the invasion again against the Milky Way, maybe for the next galaxy over, you know, the next one that they had planned to invade. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that, because the big thing about the Andromedans is, of course, that how long, the big thing that nobody knows, and I think it's the most critical thing when it comes to the invasion, is how long does it take for the Andromedans to send ships from their quote home galaxy, wherever that's the staging area is for that, to the LMC? How long did it take them to get from point A to point B? Was it decades? Was it centuries? My guess would be that it was decades.
You mean like when the trunk line was working or initially?
Well, I'm not sure how long it takes to set up. See, that's another question, is how long does it take to set up the trunk line?
Well, I guess the working hypothesis has been about 200 years, but one theory was that basically every 20 years or so, they'd establish a node. And then, so the closest node to the LMC would be 20 years of regular travel away. So once the desecrators are gone, then it would take another 20 years for them to, any ship that started at the last point would take 20 years to slow boat it to the LMC. And any ships that might have been traveling mid-flight would suddenly have to drop out of that. And maybe they take 5 or 10 years or wherever it is and stuff. So they'd be trickling in or whatever.
Right. And then, of course,
but it seems that once the trunk line is actually up and running fully, it's actually a lot quicker to get from one galaxy to another. Like, they haven't said exactly, but maybe 1 or 2 years or even a few months or whatever it is. So I guess that's why it was so important to build it in the first place.
Right. Well, I disagree that it would be only a couple of years. I would think, because here's why I say this, in that the first inklings of an Andromedan invasion happened, what, like Y-165? Was that when the
first encounters, the first encounter in the Alpha Octant was Y-166.
Y-166. Okay, so I got it off by ear. So that's when they first basically were scouting out, the way I figured, that's when they were scouting out the Milky Way to say, okay, what kind of forces that they have, what kind of weapons do they have, and so forth. So the real start of the invasion didn't start until, like, what, 184?
Well, 188 in the Alpha Octant, and okay, then about 192 in Omega.
Okay, 188. Okay.
But the thing is that the invasion kind of, in both areas, it rolled out in stages. So
right.
Like, but the Federation and Klingons weren't attacked until 192, but the ISC were the first target and so on. And right. In Omega too, actually, because they tried to set the Red Nebula up as a beachhead, so they attacked them a few times in the Y-180s. Mm-hmm. And so, but the larger scale deployment didn't happen, or invasion didn't happen until Y-192.
Right. But the point I'm getting at is that the invasion really didn't start really in earnest, the starting of it, until like Y-188, which is approximately 20 years later. Which, to me, so you got your scouts that are scouting it out maybe for a year, maybe a few years. Let's say, just for giggles, let's say for 2 years that they were investigating Milky Way. You know, looking at different parts of our galaxy, you know, at least the Alpha Octant at the very least. And they said, okay, well, we can take these guys. Now, that gets sent back to Andromeda and say, okay, this is the kind of forces we're going to need. So then they start sending them. And it takes them 20 years to get there, to get to, to the Milky Way. Because I'm not sure when the LMC was attacked. I'm not sure, did they?
Well, okay, so I think it might be worth thinking about this in two different ways. One is we know that for the RTN, there's a bandwidth limit where basically each base can only support two ships with VizDevs arriving at one time and then going off. And then they have to be as far enough a certain way for two more ships to show up and so on. Because if the ships stay, they have to switch off their VizDevs, and you could stack ships that way, but then it's much more difficult to deploy them operationally. And so it's possible that the trunk line has a similar issue where they can only maybe send a certain number of ships down it each year. But the other thing as well is that if there's anything between, the exact number hasn't been said, but if it's anything between 100 to 300 satellite bases in the Alpha Octant to build up the RTN, those don't appear overnight. So if you've only got like one or two infestors and you've got intruders and conquistadors and stuff, so those ones that aren't testing the waters would basically be moving more slowly than usual, perhaps to sort of avoid being detected and placing those bases in secret. So that would probably take, that's probably the biggest, one of the main delaying factors is that they needed those 30 years worth of time to plant so many satellite bases so that when the invasion began, they'd done their homework. So there was probably only a handful of bases in the galaxy at the time of first contact.
Mm-hmm, right.
So they were still very cautious in terms of, you know, giving the game away. Because for the Alpha Empires, they could have thought that they were just some random passers-by. I mean, there was no real... it wasn't quite obvious that they were planning an invasion. So,
right, oh, agreed.
And then also, at the same time, there was other guys like Juggernauts and stuff showing up, whatever.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They were much more open about saying, we're here to fight, whatever. So it's easier for the Andromedans to kind of slip back under the radar long enough to get the network built. So, I don't know. I mean, it would have taken a while to get the critical mass of ships in place to launch the invasion. But I think it was more of a drip, drip, drip in terms of getting them from Andromeda.
Right.
And also
step
by step in terms of getting the bases ready.
Right. Agreed. But But the point I'm trying to make is that I'm thinking, that's what I was thinking of, transport time from Andromeda to the LMC in decades and not years. Because I would think by that time they had at least set up some of what was needed for the invasion. Now, as I said, the critical thing for me is, when was the LMC actually defeated?
Okay, so that is what I'd recommend Captain's Log 49 for. And also, there's a sample PDF that's an extract from Module C5 that spells out the Andor timeline. But basically, the first arrival was in Y-138. And then over the next about 6 or 7 years, they were bringing in one intruder per year, to include right. and the Infestor as well. And what they would do is that the Infestor brought in the core components to build the first desecrator. And then over this next few years, they cleared out the region of the fringe that they were in and also started to gather resources so that they could complete the desecrator, which was finished by Y-145. And then once that happened, they flicked the switch, activated the trunk line, more ships began coming in, and then the invasion began. And by about Y-157, they'd conquered the homeworlds of the Badawi and the Yanin, and the Othiki were destroyed in Y-151. So by about Y-160, the main space of the LMC was conquered, but right. the core was still intact, and the Chomak hadn't, they had only briefly, like they hadn't really been approached yet. So for the next couple of decades, the remaining part of the LMC was put on the back burner, and the focus was on placing satellite bases in both Alpha and Omega. But then in the Y-180s, they looked back at the LMC and decided to finish business off before they really kick things off. So in Y-183, they cracked the core radiation shell, and at that point flushed out whoever was still in there. And by Y-185, they'd finished defeating the Chomak. So basically the same year that the General War came to an end, that's when the conquest of the LMC was completed. Mm-hmm. And only then did they feel that they were secure enough in the LMC to really start towards preparing the invasion.
Right.
But also there's the thing as well in terms of waiting for the target regions to be, just right. So, for example, it's probably not a coincidence that the Andromedans waited until after the ISC were finished building the pacification cordons before they launched their invasion, because that actually made their lives a lot easier. Not only just in attacking the ISC themselves, but all those cordons had the bases that had already been built had already been destroyed during the General War, or the ISC destroyed them for them. And so all they had to do is get rid of enough of the ISC bases so that that vast region of space they could dominate. And also it made it more difficult for their enemies to send shipments to each other, because the neutral zone regions had been lost at this point.
Right.
So there's that. But then also, I just catch my breath, in Omega, they probably figured out at some point that the Soldier were planning their own invasion, because it seems to be that the Soldier aren't talking either, but it seems that they prepared their invasion to piggyback on the Andromeda one. So at some point, the two sides, I mean, they weren't allied, like they fought each other plenty of times, but they both seem to become aware at some point that something was afoot, whatever. So,
saw what the Andromedans were up to and just waited. It's like, and just figured the best time for them to invade was right after the Andromedans did their invasion and just kind of piggyback on it. Because most chaos, like, okay, while you're attacking over here, we're going to attack too. So that, even less force that we have to defeat ourselves.
True. And also, around that time was when the Second Great War of Omega was coming to an end. So the empires were already, they were coming to the same point of exhaustion that was seen in other places. So it was probably about as good a time as it was going to get to, you know, pounce on that in terms of launching the Andromeda invasion. So.
That would have been interesting. I'm just looking at some of the ships from Module C-3A, and one of them is the Andromeda Cobra Plus, where basically they put TR heavies on the ship. Yikes.
Yeah, some of the stuff in C-3A is basically... because I think the Cobras, that's what they had before the TRL was invented in for Captain's Edition or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm not really familiar
with
that.
Yeah, the Cobras actually had, they only had tractor repulsor beams. There was no heavy and light versions before the Captain's Edition. So yeah, the Cobras initially had basically TR heavies.
But, I was going to say. Yeah. Actually, one thing is, in terms of future products, there is a thread which, because may have mentioned the Darwin scenario and the dark future that they are involved. Now, there's some information about that timeline in Module C-3A, but in theory, there could be a future product that goes into that timeline in more detail, mm-hmm. like for things like scenarios and new ships and so forth. And one thing that's interesting is that I'm really trying to catch my breath. the Federation in that timeline, they eventually start deploying gunboats. So it would be an excuse for people to get those new PF packs on Shapeways.
Mm-hmm.
But also it would give the Andromedans opportunities to have more scenarios that feature the dissection beam.
Yep. Actually, was it the dissection beam was the only one that came from the alternate future? Alternate timeline?
That's right. All the other new weapons like the or systems and stuff were just made up in the simulators.
Okay, so like the spatial distortion field was one of them.
Yeah, it was basically like they thought that they might come up with something like that, but they didn't.
Right.
Even in the other timeline.
Yeah, the spatial distorter is a hypothesized Andromedan system with the effect similar to the temporal elevator. Oh, that's an interesting. Don't like it. If it existed, it would have been used to defend the drone mothership and satellite ships or to disrupt the operations of the enemy units. Yeah. I still remember the temporal elevator and the whole idea of levels. So you kind of push it away. You know, I think the whole idea was, yeah, I remember the temporal elevator, the original idea behind it was to have a defense against plasmas. For the bases, and they decided that didn't quite work. So that's when they came up the PA mines, which are quite cool. To suck the energy out.
Well,
the plasmas.
I suppose the interesting thing about the Andromedan bases is that because for a lot of other empires. Bases project power because they've got things like phaser fours and more heavy weapons
right,
and stuff,
right.
whatever. But of course, in the case of the Andromedans, it's the reverse. Like their base is, they're supposed to be hidden, but if they're ever discovered, then it's almost like a pirate base, basically. In that, I guess the point is that you can basically pack it up and move it again, which would be an interesting thing to figure out for F&E terms, whatever, is that. Because if you have like a base that's just a single satellite base,
mm-hmm.
presumably the time it takes to deactivate it and transport it onto a mothership and move it somewhere else is much lower. Because if you have a battle station, It's most likely, I guess, it's never sure, but like you might have to basically switch the base off and then dismantle all four components.
Right.
And beam each of them up separately, because I don't think you'd be allowed to transport the entire base all at once.
Right, right. So agreed. Agreed.
What doing is like, yeah, you're bringing it to a new location and then you're reassembling it and stuff. So there's all those kind of things and stuff that you'd need to figure out in terms of.
Yeah. But of course, for something like that, the real question in my mind is, would they be built to be disassembled? Because of, I can totally understand the whole idea of, okay, that you use the satellite bases to create the battle stations and the base stations. You can piece them together. Those are the main modules. And then you can add a structure to connect them and make them work together. You know, when it comes to cable, you know, electric, you know, power cable, power, you know, power conduits and things like that, where you can actually have it act as a base, you know, that works together. But the question is, with that same base, you know, when they were putting it together, would there be ability to basically to disassemble it? Because I would think in most cases, what you'd be doing is you'd be basically soldering it to, you know, welding it together. And when you weld it together, usually, you know, welds aren't designed to be broken and taken apart. You know, now obviously these are Andromedans, so it's possible they might want, you know, we need to be able to tear these things down quickly and move them. So there might be this one of those abilities that the Andromedans have because of the way they built their bases.
I'm actually just looking back in the module C3 rules to see if there's anything they say about disassembling the bases.
Right.
Because usually, like, when you're assembling them, of course, they count just as cargo boxes and stuff until the systems are activated. But
right, and normally those kind of things, like any other base, are, you know, yeah, they're as inside pods, or they're towed there, and so forth. And they normally, when it comes to rules, they don't cover them, because most of those rules are designed for tactical situations. And normally you don't activate a, you don't put together a star base in the middle of a battle. You know.
Well, it says here, the control boxes. The core module, if in a legal configuration, cannot undock satellite bases during a scenario. So does that mean that if it's between scenarios, they can't undock? Then you can pack them up separately? I don't know.
I would think you could.
Or in certain scenarios, another module might appear in which you get to dock its satellite bases. Blah, blah, blah.
But again, that's one of those things that's more of a strategic versus tactical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something, it definitely would be something for F&E's kind of things. And even that would probably abstract it to a certain degree, where you would, instead of disassembling it, would you just say it takes longer to move a battle station or base station versus a satellite base? You know, they just add more time to it. You know? Though, again, even those, the problem is the F&E time scale is what, six? What's the time scale for a turn in F&E? Do you remember?
6 months.
I thought it was 6 months too. I don't think it would take 6 months to disassemble a base that was meant to be disassembled. I would think it would take might take a day or more or whatever. If it was meant to be disassembled.
So it might be a Federation Admiral that was being discussed, the campaign level, the operational level game.
Right, right.
So that's like below the level of F&E, but above the level of SFB or FedCom.
Exactly.
So maybe in that kind of game system, there'd be some sort of accounting for this.
Agreed. Okay. Well, with that, actually, wow.
Oh, actually, one final thing.
Okay, yes, go.
Just one final thing is for anyone who's interested in Module C3A, there actually is a very prominent historical campaign that's in it about the fall of Demorak. That's the capital of the LDR. So there's rules about how to play out the campaign and also references to two other scenarios. One of them is in Module X1R, and that features the Red Guard. That's basically the LDR's X Squadron. And also there's a separate scenario which refers to some of the units that had been held in reserve at the capital, and they were sent to defend this other colony at the time that the main conquest happened. So there's rules about, like, if you play those other scenarios first, then that might impact whether or not you get those ships
right
in showing up, like, against Demorak itself.
Hmm? Yeah.
Or on behalf of Demorak, rather.
Right, because these are... this is a mini campaign, is what it is.
That's right. And actually, I think it would be a good scale of event to playtest, like, any future Andro rules for a Fedan Empire, because we know what's supposed to happen, and the orders of battle are kind of, like, you know, there's FNE Minor Empires is already in print, and the campaign in Module C3A tells you how many dominators or intruders or whatever you have. So there might be a way to put it all together and then see how well the rules work in that scale.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. That would be interesting. And then, of course, they had the assault on Demorak. Whew. How much? Okay, two motherships, associated satellite ships within 40 hexes of Demorak and direction of the player's options. Historically, the Andromedan force in the first attack was two dominators carrying an eel, a terminator, and four cobras. Wow. That's one thing I never really thought about much. Which is basically, what is better to have? More, smaller satellite ships or fewer larger satellite ships? Obviously, the larger satellite ships can take more punishment, but the great thing about having the smaller ships is that it takes, basically, in my mind anyway, more damage to kill a number of smaller ships because of you have the whole issue with overkill. So, anyhow. We'll end it there because of it's getting late. Gary, it was wonderful to have you call up and have us chat.
Okay. Have a good night. Okay. And hopefully we'll get a chance to chat with Barry in the near future.
Yep. And hopefully we can talk about the Sigvarians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You have a good night.
Thank you.
So we had a nice discussion with Gary here about the Andromedans. You have both the C3A module and even some historical context of the Andromedans, which in my mind I've always been fascinated with because of not much is really, really known about, one, why did they invade? They invaded probably because of resource and so forth. Because you don't normally attack someone just to attack them. That makes no sense. It's a waste of resources. You know, you can do that so much, and you know, there's going to be ships and resources are going to be going to waste. I'm assuming that they want to expand their empire or something along those lines. But of course, expand the empire, then you'll get more resources and so forth. That's why the whole idea of when it comes to planets, when you invade another empire, when it comes to, and you know, in galactic terms, that you don't wipe out the planet, you don't bombard it from space and make it basically glass. You don't do that. You only do that to set an example to others to say, this is what we can do and we will do. and the whole idea is to capture the planet, get the resources that are on that planet, whether it is both people and, you know, mineral, like mineral resource, things like that, or just, you know, in some cases, you have to do the inevitable, which is, you know, kill them all. If you have to, just to show what you can do to others, you know, as an example. But anyhow, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.